The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Today is December 7th, 2017, and what a life-changing date this is, or was, for me personally. Many, many years ago, it was on December 7th, 1996, that I proposed to my lovely wife, a life-changing experience, for sure. It's made my life so much better, so much fuller. And, well, this is also the anniversary of my father's firing and the establishment of the Philadelphia Church of God. Many of you were probably waiting for that tidbit and are familiar with some of the history that followed that firing. Obviously, that's a meaningful date for so many of us that continue in the traditions of Herbert W. Armstrong, his teachings. And coming up on today's show, we'll talk about that special anniversary. That'll be coming up in the next segment after we run through some of the most newsworthy headlines. Southern California continues to go up in flames. Multiple fires now have torched, I think, over 100,000 acres of land, and 200,000 Californians have been forced to evacuate or have at least received evacuation orders. According to CAL FIRE, there are at least 16 wildfires right now raging in California. Five of them are uncontained, and officials are warning that it's only going to get worse because of the strong Santa Ana winds. And then, of course, the extremely dry conditions, all of this thirsty vegetation that's just getting torched by these wildfires. The Weather Service has categorized, just to give you some idea of the risk factor here, they've categorized Southwest California as an extremely critical risk zone. This is according to the Los Angeles Brush Burning Index. It gives the indication of the fire danger. It says if the number is above 165, again, which means nothing to us, but if it's above that, it means the fire danger is extreme. And right now it's at 296. So it's an extreme danger that Southern California is facing. And you've probably seen pictures even of it jumping the highways and putting even some prominent structures in danger. So as I said yesterday, we'll certainly keep our eyes on that. California for decades now has just gotten pounded. We've written about California. Once it was considered to be the golden state in America. It really was the symbol of prosperity and abundance for all of the U.S., for all of the world, in fact. But a lot has changed since that golden era. Going back to the 1940s or 50s, you look at the state today, it's just gotten pounded by natural disasters like this, earthquakes, illegal immigration, all sorts of things. You can go to thetrumpet.com and just run a search on California and no doubt read quite a lot from the past two decades on the curses that have set in. Last night, Brad McDonald sent out a Trumpet brief on Jerusalem and Donald Trump's, as he said, entirely unremarkable declaration. Of course, he's referring to President Trump's official recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital and his pledge to move America's embassy to Jerusalem.
Therefore, I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. While previous presidents have made this a major campaign promise, they failed to deliver. Today, I am delivering.
Today, America is following through, finally, to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. As Brad McDonald said in his brief, apparently this earth-shattering pronouncement is the kiss of death for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. It dramatically intensifies the tension between the Muslim world and Israel, and between the West and Muslims, and it is guaranteed to plunge the region and the world into a fire with no end. He's just paraphrasing some of the hysterical reaction that's come from all over the world. And yet, as I said yesterday on the program, for the past 20 years, I mean, every politician in Washington has pledged to do exactly what President Trump is now doing. And so now that it's happening, you have all of these politicians previous to this who pledged the very same thing. Now they're up in arms. Now they're beside themselves. Well, this is going to ruin everything. This is going to kill the peace process. We'll talk more about that sham in just a minute. Here's another snippet from President Trump's speech yesterday, clip two.
Presidents issued these waivers under the belief that delaying the recognition of Jerusalem would advance the cause of peace. Some say they lacked courage, but they made their best judgments based on facts as they understood them at the time. Nevertheless, the record is in. After more than two decades of waivers, we are no closer to a lasting peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. It would be folly to assume that repeating the exact same formula would now produce a different or better result.
That's the president yesterday from his speech pledging to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to move the embassy, the U.S. embassy, to Jerusalem. The record is in, he said. Two decades of waivers. I mentioned some of this history yesterday, how that since 1995, with overwhelming support from both houses in Congress, and then the presidents, Presidents Clinton, Bush, Obama, all of them, every single one pledging to move the embassy, pledging to recognize Jerusalem, and then every single one signing the waiver every 6 months. Now, we know, I also went through some of this with you yesterday, we know that Jerusalem is a powder keg, and we know that eventually that city is going to explode in violence. Your Bible prophesies of this. But President Trump is right to draw attention to the record. What has the status quo accomplished exactly? Make sure that you read Brad McDonald's trumpet brief from last night. We posted it at thetrumpet.com. You can see it at his blog page there on the website. Some important history that he covers in that brief. It's a fairly long one this time, but it's important history to go through. And he, as I say, he also has a lot to say about the hysterical reaction. One final clip here from the speech, clip three.
However, through all of these years, presidents representing the United States have declined to officially recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. In fact, we have declined to acknowledge any Israeli capital at all. But today we finally acknowledge the obvious, that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. This is nothing more or less than a recognition of reality.
A recognition of reality. Here is the United States acknowledging the obvious. The obvious. As Brad McDonald said in the brief, really all Mr. Trump did, all that he did yesterday was formally recognize a demonstrable truth, a truth that rational human beings the world over have acknowledged and accepted for 4,000 years. It's since the time of Abraham. You could go back before ancient Israel to the days of Abraham. A 4,000-year history in this city. Who can lay claim to that? As Winston Churchill said back in 1955, you ought to let the Jews have Jerusalem. It was they who made it famous. I mean, they're the ones that made it famous. The city itself's mentioned in the Bible hundreds and hundreds of times. But this is the point I really want to key in on. This was brought out in the trumpet brief. Brad McDonald writes, "What does it reveal about the intellectual and moral health of Western civilization that so many people can so easily ignore or reject truth? That so many world leaders, journalists, and regular people in blind pursuit of ideology are willing to simply abolish and bury what is now verifiable fact." What does it say about our world today, about Western civilization, about commentators in America and Great Britain? What does it say about our health, our moral health, when we can so easily ignore the truth? Thomas Friedman had a piece in the New York Times yesterday about our so-called obsession with Iran. He said the greatest thing that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia could do is to stop working each other into a lather over this Iranian threat. He has threat in scare quotes. Evidently, the warnings about the number one state sponsor of terror are overblown. It's not really that much of a threat to speak of. So says Thomas Friedman at the New York Times. The greatest thing that we could do is to stop working each other into a lather over this Iranian threat and to focus instead on their domestic reform. I assume there he means Iran. Iran's domestic reform. He says later on, but just about the last thing Saudi Arabia or any of our Arab allies need right now is for President Trump to do what the White House says he will do Wednesday, announce plans to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Thomas Friedman says, "I can't think of anything more unnecessary and destabilizing." See, it's just like Brad McDonald said. This is the end of the world as far as they see it. This is the end of the peace process. The Middle East is now sure to go up in flames. He says he can't see anything more unnecessary or destabilizing than moving the embassy to Jerusalem. Nothing more destabilizing, not even the Iran nuke deal, which cleared the way for Iran to build a nuclear weapon over the next decade. Not even handing Iran, the mullahs, hundreds of billions of dollars in sanction relief. That wasn't destabilizing. Not even the declaration by the Obama administration just 11 months ago that a Jewish presence in the old city of Jerusalem and at the Western Wall is illegitimate. None of that's destabilizing. None of that was unnecessary. But moving an embassy to the capital city that everyone in the world knows is the capital city, and that every politician in Washington has pledged to do over the last 22 years. That now is seen as unnecessary, destabilizing, and on and on and on it goes. Listen to what he says. This is Friedman's article. Iran is richly talented. It has a richly talented population, a rich Persian culture. But instead of unleashing both and enabling Iran's youth to realize their full potential and making the country influential that way, the Ayatollahs are suppressing those talents at home and unleashing the power of Shiite mercenaries on Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, and compelling influence that way instead. So I guess Iran is a threat after all. Or wait a minute, it's not a threat. It's overblown. But if that is to be accepted as truth, who is it that helped to fund these operations, these mercenaries in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen? If the mullahs aren't spending it on their talent at home, if the mullahs aren't spending it to enrich Persian culture, what are they spending it on? Friedman answers, mercenaries in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, which begs the question, why would you give them then hundreds of billions of dollars? And who did that? Which administration did that? Which president is responsible for that? He says here, finally, President Trump's decision, this move to recognize Jerusalem, to move the embassy, he says, is such a pathetic way to disguise the fact that America really is not present in the Middle East these days. Our ability to shape events there is less than any time since World War II. And I can't say I disagree with the fact that America's presence in the Middle East is pretty much disappearing. But here again, how can the current president be blamed for this? It's the previous occupant of the White House who withdrew, for the most part, all the troops out of the region, the U.S. troops. President Obama's the one that drew the red line over Syrian chemical weapons and then erased it and handed Syria to the Russians. Russia took care of getting rid of those chemical weapons. Russia took care of propping up Assad. It's the Obama administration that's responsible for blowing up the region during the Arab Spring, and then it left Iran and ISIS to pick up the pieces. Obama's the one that's responsible for the Iran nuke deal. Obama's the one that's responsible for funding the Ayatollahs so that they can pay for the Shiite mercenaries in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. That's Friedman's words. It's the previous administration that decided not even to defend the American compound in Benghazi, even as it was being attacked. That's the truth. But like Mr. McDonald brings out in his trumpet brief, who wants the truth? Who wants the truth? When you've got such a popular and widespread ideology, a biased ideology, an ideology that's not even grounded in fact. There was an article at the American Spectator. I've got a lot of it, actually, that I want to read. I kept reading through it this morning, trying to delete some things that I could skip over. But it's an Dove Fisher writing his article of thanks to President Trump for just simply keeping his promise, for just simply following through on his pledge. Fisher writes, Bill Clinton made the exact same promise. So did George W. Bush. So did President Obama. Some of that history, again, from 1995. All of the congressional support when the law was passed in 95. And then along comes Donald Trump. And he actually keeps the promise, and the world goes absolutely berserk. He writes here, this is at the American Spectator, as the chicken-hearted, yellow-bellied, lily-livered, gutless, and spineless leaders of Western civilization from Western Europe to New Zealand now shake and tremble in the face of a simple truth that they all know, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, we may expect to hear the meme interminably, day and night, until the next television or movie icon's pants fall, that this decision now threatens the Middle East peace process. That will be the big story in the days ahead until there's another sexual misconduct scandal. He says, for the last 50 years, someone in a European capital and in the U.S. State Department has uttered the sentence at least once weekly. If Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston divorce, it will endanger the Middle East peace process. If Megyn Kelly ever gets ratings on NBC, it will endanger the Middle East peace process. If Hillary Clinton admits that she knowingly spoliated, not sure what that word means, those emails and that they had nothing to do with yoga, yogurt, or Chelsea's wedding, it will endanger the Middle East peace process. You get the idea. He says further on, so while other experts debate the meme, let us share a secret. There is no Middle East peace process. And there has not been a Middle East peace process for decades. It's a sham. There is no peace process. They have people, just like the Bible says, that talk about peace. Diplomats, presidents, congressmen. But what have been the facts on the ground? What is the truth? He says Yasser Arafat visited the White House more than did any other foreign visitor. With Clinton, this is during Clinton's administration, with Clinton brutally pressuring Israel's most ineffective and hapless prime minister in its history, Ehud Barak, Arafat was promised, listen to this, I went through some of it yesterday, I know, but it says Arafat was promised virtually everything he always had said he was demanding. The West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, the Temple Mount. That's me speaking. It's all covered there in Dory Gold's book, The Fight for Jerusalem. Go through it. Go through what transpired in those negotiations between Arafat and Barak. He was promised virtually everything he had always said that he was demanding, but the butcher turned it down anyway and instead launched a civilian war, the so-called Intifada. He walked away from the negotiating table and instead launched the Intifada that resulted in thousands of deaths. Says Arafat and his cronies, chief among them Mahmoud Abbas, the current Palestinian Authority dictator, who is now entering the 13th year of his four-year elected term in office, never wanted a final agreement that would recognize the permanent existence of a non-Muslim Jewish-majority country in the Middle East. They don't want an Israeli presence. They don't want a Jewish presence. That is a hard truth that most people refuse to accept. He says there never was a Middle East peace process. Rather, it was a peace process. That's P-I-E-C-E. In other words, give up a piece of land. Give up a piece of land for a document. And then when another gullible president comes along, just to paraphrase what he says here, seek after another peace. Sinai, Gaza, and so on. It says further, there never was a peace process, and if one simply pauses to contemplate the reality of the terrain and the demography, the painful conclusion is that a two-state solution is best when not contemplated. So he then runs through some history, and again, I think it's important just to try to get some context to build on what Brad McDonald said in the trumpet brief. I mean, if ever there's anything that shows just how divorced from reality so many people are, it's the so-called Middle East peace process. Before June 1967, an Arab-Muslim polity, Egypt, held Gaza, and then it has an Arab-Muslim government, Syria, held the Golan Heights, an Arab-Muslim nation, Jordan, held Judea and Samaria. That's, as he said, been misnomered the West Bank, and he touches on that a little bit later in the article. But he takes you back to 1967, before the 67 war. when Egypt controlled Gaza, Syria controlled the Golan Heights, and Jordan controlled all of Judea and Samaria and East Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. It says, yet in 1964, 3 years before June 1967, the Arab world created the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO. Which Palestine did that organization set about to liberate in 1964? Not Gaza, Golan, and Judea and Samaria. Jordanian Olympic athletes were not attacked for occupying the West Bank, nor were Egyptian schoolchildren for occupying Gaza, nor Syrian civilians for occupying the Golan. Rather, all PLO terror attacks from the PLO's 1964 founding through June 1967 aimed within pre-June 1967 Israel. All the attacks, when the Arabs owned all of that land that the Palestinians are supposedly seeking, that Yasser Arafat was supposedly seeking in the year 2000, that Mahmoud Abbas apparently wants, and everything's solved and finished. Well, what about that time before 1967 when Israel didn't have any of that land? And the PLO attacks were aimed at the tiniest of tiniest portions. Israel before the 1967 war. He says further, by the way, how fascinating is the term West Bank? The Arab world could not assert with a straight face that Judea and Samaria belonged to the PLO, so they gave it a different name. Only they had no other name for it, because Judea and Samaria never were part of their universe. Read the Torah, read the Christian Gospels, read the Encyclopedia Britannica before the 1960s. I mean, you want the truth? That's what he's saying. If you want the truth, you can go get it. So since Judea and Samaria lands are west of the Jordan River, they denominated it the West Bank. Anyone who has been there to cities up and down Judea and Samaria knows that the region is no riverbank, not remotely close to the Jordan River. Yet the mainstream leftist media use the term West Bank rather than Judea and Samaria because they claim to shun the biblical name. But they call everywhere else in that region by their biblical names: Bethlehem, Nazareth, Galilee, Jericho, Hebron, Negev, Syria, Damascus, Lebanon, Tyre, Nineveh, Sidon, Jordan, Egypt, and Jerusalem, which brings back the fallacy of the Mideast peace process meme. Everything goes by its biblical name except the West Bank. He says, today more than 200,000 Jews live in the eastern part of Jerusalem. Another 420,000 live in the West Bank area, or Judea and Samaria. What happens to these hundreds of thousands of Jews? Even if you give up all of that area, that he talks about some cities in the West Bank having 40,000 Jews in them. That's like the size of New Hampshire's third largest city. We got to get back to the peace process, don't you know? We've got to empty out the West Bank and East Jerusalem and give full control to the Palestinian for their statehood. Okay, so if that happens, what do you do? It was tricky even 2000 when they tried, as I said yesterday, they had to try to draw up all these regions that they could swap because it was unrealistic to think about moving 40,000 people. He brings up the point about Gaza, Gush Katif, which I visited a few years ago. That's the one they uprooted back when the Israelis evacuated from Gaza. I forget the exact date. I think it was 2006 or 7. 8,600 Israelis, and they're still living in camps. It's been that hard to absorb 8,600 Israelis. So what do you do with 640,000 or 620,000? It says the earliest Middle East peace process for 20, he has that in quotes for obvious reasons, for 20 years from 1948 to 67 included a solution. Simply drive the Jews to their deaths in the Mediterranean Sea. That was the Middle East peace process from 1947 or 1948 when Israel was established as a state to 1967, the Six-Day War. The process, as far as Israel's neighbors were concerned, was to drive the Jews into the sea. He says, despite the solution's neatness and elegance, the Arab Muslim world changed the meme from drive the Jews into the sea after the June 1967 war. In time, it became the peace process without any thought as to the actual relocation of the 620,000 Jews. But if they are not to be slaughtered, a solution the intransigent Israeli Likud government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu resolutely continues to oppose despite UN intractability, as do most other Israeli political parties. What indeed is that part of the peace process? He goes through some of that history with Gaza and Hamas and the Gush Katif settlement. And then finally, there's this. One more thing. Look at the logo of the Hamas terrorists. See that green, jagged dagger, quote unquote, on the center top? Now look at the logo of the Palestinian Authority's Al-Fatah terrorists. See that green, jagged dagger in the middle, partially obstructed by the two superimposed rifles? Now look at the logo of the terrorist Islamic Jihad. See that same jagged dagger, only this time in red and in the middle? One picture is worth a thousand words. Yet another meme. That depiction is not a jagged dagger. Rather, it is the map of Palestine that Hamas, Fatah, and Islamic Jihad all are determined to attain as part of the Middle East peace process. The thing is, for the uninitiated, that Palestine, on their mind, is not a map of Gaza and the West Bank. Rather, that is the exact map of all of Israel, down to Tel Aviv, Haifa, Hadera, Tiberias, Masada, Eilat, and the Ben-Gurion Airport. For the Arab Muslim world, Palestine is Israel, all of it. All of it. Nothing has changed, he says. One need not be fluent in Hebrew nor in Arabic to grasp this. Simply capable of looking at four pictures tells the whole story. The Middle East peace process, he asks? What peace process? Make sure that if you haven't read it by now, the trumpet brief that Brad McDonald sent out last night, go back and get that history, get that important history. I mean, really, what does it reveal, as he says, about the intellectual and moral health of Western civilization that so many people can so easily ignore or reject the truth? You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email the program at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
28 years ago today, I was on the Ambassador College campus in Big Sandy, Texas. It was a cold and rainy day, and a lot of us students were huddled around the beautiful sculpture outside, Swans in Flight, waiting for a ceremony on this dreary afternoon. On this day, this is when Mr. Armstrong's successor, Joseph Tkach, he was on campus that day, so it was a big day. Everyone was excited to see the Pastor General, and he was there to break ground on a new headquarters building to be constructed right in front of that Swans in Flight sculpture. And as many of you know, the church and the college had been going through a number of disturbing changes leading up to this day, December 7th, 1989. He wrote, Mr. Tkach did, around that same time, "Under careful study is also the possibility of moving one or more major departments of the work to Big Sandy, where costs of construction are significantly less than Pasadena." So they were working to move their headquarters facility over to Big Sandy, East Texas, where it was cheaper, as he said there. And this comes after that Mr. Armstrong decided there in the last year of his life that Big Sandy should be closed for the work's sake. Mr. Tkach came in and immediately reversed that decision, opened Big Sandy, and now here you are, not less than 4 years later. And Mr. Tkach is not only there at Big Sandy, but he's announcing a move, the possibility of moving headquarters. He said, "I believe God is now leading me to see that a consolidation of as many of our resources, personnel, and operations as possible at our less expensive facility may make good sense in preparation for the bumpy economic times ahead." Well, and if you look back at some of the internal documents leading up to this day, December 7th, 1989, and that groundbreaking ceremony and that PGR that I just quoted from, they were already securing more property in and around Big Sandy area, preparing. They were in the midst of a massive construction project with multiple dormitories and other buildings on campus. And the centerpiece of all this, of course, was the Hall of Administration, the building they were going to build right out in front or right behind these Swans in Flight. This was to be the church's world headquarters. And as I wrote about in Raising the Ruins, what's really remarkable about this history is that on this very day, December 7th, 1989, the day that Mr. Tkach broke ground for that new headquarters facility in Big Sandy, God actually was transferring his government to another facility. It wasn't working out the way the Tkaches wanted it to. But on that same day, December 7th, 1989, my father and John Amos, they were summoned to Pasadena, California. That was where the Worldwide Church of God headquarters was situated. It was in the early morning hours of December 7th that Tkach Jr., Mr. Tkach's son, he called my father in his Edmond home and demanded that he and Mr. Amos board a plane to California that very day if they had any hope of retaining their jobs. He had gotten a report from someone that said my father had put together a manuscript called Malachi's Message to God's Church Today. So they were called out to Pasadena. They did get on a plane that same day. They arrived in the late afternoon period of December 7th in Southern California, checked into a hotel in Pasadena. And then that night, December 7th, 1989, for 4 hours, they went back and forth. My father and Mr. Amos, they went back and forth with Joseph Tkach Jr. and Michael Fazell, his assistant. This was their opportunity, my father's opportunity, and Mr. Amos's opportunity to vent. Mystery of the Ages had been canceled, discontinued. The television program, The World Tomorrow, had been getting weaker and weaker. And so they complained about that. They said, look, the church is going in a disturbing direction. Mr. Tkach Jr. responded by saying, let me see if I understand what you're saying. You're saying that you can run the church better than my father can. That was his response. But my father and Mr. Amos, they stayed on point. They focused on what the church was doing. The fruits of what they were doing, discontinuing Mystery of the Ages. And it was in the midst of that exchange that Joe Tkach Jr. came out with this astonishing statement that Mystery of the Ages, this is not even 4 years after the death of Herbert Armstrong. He made the statement that Mystery of the Ages was riddled with error. Just riddled with error, front to back. Well, my father didn't agree with that. He disagreed with it strenuously, as did Mr. Amos. And later on that night, both of them were fired from their positions in the ministry. Both of them had been ministers in the Worldwide Church of God for a number of years. My father for almost 2 decades. I think about the same for Mr. Amos. I'm not exactly sure on the number of years with him, but they were fired by this man, the son of Mr. Tkach, who had been employed by the church for just 3 years, fired and excommunicated from the church. And years later, when we were in the midst of the Mystery of the Ages lawsuit, I think this would have been 1998. I know we had a round of depositions in 98 and then another round in 2002. But when hearkening back to this firing, Joe Tkach Jr. acknowledged that he's the one that was responsible for the decision entirely. His father didn't even know about it. Before his father got back from Big Sandy, my father and John Amos had been fired and excommunicated. Well, going back to that December 7 meeting, my father, if you have read Malachi's Message, you're familiar with this. He told Joseph Tkach Jr., he told Michael Fazell that this was going to be the first sip of a very bitter cup that they would have to drink. The first sip of a bitter cup. This morning in class, I mentioned how that when the Philadelphia Church of God started, on that very day, December 7th, 1989, that there was just the 12 people, two ministers, four families, 12 people total, and how that in the weeks that followed, they were having a good time with this little podunk outfit in Edmond, Oklahoma. One of their evangelists called it a peanut shell, floating on an ocean, going nowhere. Eventually, it would be gone. On the other hand, my father said to them, this massive church, bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of members, coworkers, donors, sprawling campuses in Pasadena, Big Sandy, feast sites, youth camps, all over the world, television, 400 stations, Plain Truth Magazine, millions and millions of subscribers. And my father said to them, this is the first sip. This is just the sip, the first sip of a bitter cup that you're going to have to drink. My father also, he quotes from Acts 5, and I just want to read through that, this statement that Gamaliel makes. This is in Malachi's message, one of the verses at least. But in Acts 5 here in verse 28, it says, saying, did not we straitly command you that you should not teach in this name? And behold, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us. Peter and the apostles, I'm picking it up in the middle here, but Peter and the apostles had been thrown in jail by the Pharisees and the Sadducees in Jerusalem. All of these Jews in Jerusalem, for some reason. And as it is recounted here in Acts 5, God miraculously intervened to set them free from prison. And then they come before this council again. Notice verse 29. Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. The God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you slew and hanged on a tree. That's the truth. This is the truth I'm presenting to you. They didn't accept it. It continues, him has God exalted in his right hand, with his right hand, to be prince and savior, it says, for to give repentance to Israel and forgiveness of sins. And we are his witnesses, verse 32 says. Witnesses of these things, and so is also the Holy Spirit, whom God has given to them who obey him. Verse 33 in Acts 5 says, when they heard that, they were cut to the heart and took counsel to slay them. Peter was, he was speaking with boldness and courage. And this council, this opposition to the true church, they wanted to kill him right then and there. Notice what happens. Verse 34, then stood there up one of the council, a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a doctor of the law, had in reputation among all the people, and commanded to put the apostles forth a little space. I mean, he's the one, he had a distinguished reputation among the Jews, a doctor in the law, and so he calmed the mob down a little bit. And then down in verse 38, notice what it says, and now I say unto you, refrain from these men and let them alone. For if this counsel or this work be of men, it will come to naught. But if it be of God, you cannot overthrow it, lest haply you be found to fight against it. So as I say, my father quotes from this or paraphrases it in Malachi's message, and then he says toward the end of the book, look, if this work is not of God, if it's just a human effort, it's not going to come to anything. But if God is behind it, no man will stop it. No man will stop this work. He was paraphrasing Gamaliel right from Acts 5. Now you look at what happened to those two men, my father and John Amos, as they left that office December 7th, late December 7th, 1989, and then flew home, or in the case of my father, he drove home. My sister took his plane ticket to get home, and she quit her job the same day. Just 12 of them. Four families, four homes in Edmond, Oklahoma. No headquarters complex, no college, no magazine, no TV, no radio, no place to even meet for services except in a living room. That was the Philadelphia Church of God in 1989. Conversely, as I just described, you have this sprawling church, this worldwide work. And at that time, all of this hoopla surrounding the groundbreaking in Big Sandy, Texas, Moving headquarters is so much cheaper. It'd be so much better for God's employees, for the college. They were pursuing accreditation as well. That was really the real reason. They wanted to move everything to Big Sandy. But this plan got off to such a strong start. Looking at it on the surface, so much money, so many resources put into East Texas, into the Big Sandy campus. The push to become accredited. That happened in 1994. Just 5 years or so after that meeting, 5 years or so after that groundbreaking at Big Sandy in front of the Swans in Flight. And then, well, everything began to fall apart. A year after they obtained accreditation, Mr. DeKotch Sr., he died of brain cancer. That was in 1995. And then the following year, December of 1996, the Ambassador College, or by this time it's called the Ambassador University Board of Regents, they made the announcement that the college would be closing later that spring. And the local papers in and around Big Sandy, East Texas, all of these headlines, here's this massive college right in their own neighborhood, closing its doors. That was in 1997. The Big Sandy campus was sold off in March of 2000. 2,200 acres, 50 buildings, multi-million dollar structures, sold off to the highest bidder. The same thing happened with the Pasadena campus. Same thing with the Plains. They went off TV. They stopped the plain truth. You don't see a worldwide member anywhere near those campuses today. I've forgotten where they even moved, the few that are left. Who ended up being the peanut shell? Amos 9, verses 11 and 12. I think some of you are very familiar with those verses about the work that continues today through the Philadelphia Church of God. Started with those 12 people. Started with just one pastor general, two ministers, $80 in the bank account, I think it is. $80. And yet the work that God has done to raise up the ruins, as it says there in Amos 9, to raise up the ruins of Mr. Armstrong's work and even the ruins of King David's throne. That's what's happening. What a God we serve, not by might nor by power, but by the Holy Spirit. Zechariah 4 and verse 6. How great is God to perform this work through such a tiny flock? And furthermore, how awesome and great it is to be involved in this end of the end time work of God. My father said years ago, this was in a forum, he was speaking to the faculty at God's College, and this was on the campus in Edmond, Oklahoma, where we now have the Armstrong Auditorium and a 160-acre campus, and now we have an Edstone campus. 28 years on, in any event, he said at this forum, he was telling the students about his own experiences early on with Ambassador College and early on as a ministerial trainee, and how that he got really discouraged at one point and wanted to just give up. And he was sitting in front of a minister who was counseling him, who said that God didn't call us to quit. He didn't call us to quit. He didn't call us to be mediocre either. He called us to be great. He called us to enthusiastically support his plan for us and for this whole world, for the whole universe. That's why we've been brought into this church and work. He said in that forum, it's miraculous what God will do in your life if you won't quit. If you just set your mind and set your heart on the things of God. Two people coming out of that meeting, 12 people the following Sabbath, and many others who've come along in the 28 years since. And the ones still here today haven't quit. 12 people, $80, a few hundred names and addresses, and a manuscript, Malachi's message to God's church today. It was exactly what God needed to do his work. The poor of the world, as the scriptures say, but rich in faith. To all the members, co-workers, and donors who have remained steadfast and resolute in their support for God's work, the Philadelphia Church of God, in these last days. Happy anniversary. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email the program if you like, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.